and at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are sharing with you two fascinating interviews from WGTD's archive of past morning shows, both related to people of the Jewish faith and or people who live in Israel. Here's part one.
Really beautiful.
For a long time now, I have realized that I do not know nearly as much as I should know and need to know about the Jewish faith and about Jews around the world and their long, rich, and complex history. And I have learned so very much after taking in hand a beautiful, spectacularly beautiful book called The Diaspora and the Lost Tribes of Israel. Diaspora is a very interesting term, and I am almost embarrassed to admit that it was a term I was not acquainted with until I read this book. It comes, I should think, from the same root word as when we say something is dispersed, and it essentially talks about the disbursement of the Jewish people really across the globe, and out of that sense of what is talked about in the book at one point as the landlessness of the Jews. And that has really informed and affected so much of the way they have lived their lives and lived out their faith. The author of this splendid book is Amos Asael, and he is responsible for this book. He is the executive editor of the Jerusalem Post and has advanced degrees in history and journalism. And is actually living now in Jerusalem with his family and is calling us from there to talk about this beautiful book. And we welcome you, Amos Asael, to the morning show.
Hi, good to be with you.
Thank you so much. And I must say, this is an incredible book. I should also tell, for the sake of our listeners, that this is a gigantic book just to take it in your hands. I mean, it's a huge book full of information and splendid photographs. Tell us just briefly, if you would, how this book came into being. Was it your idea or someone else's idea that the history of the Jewish people should be told in this particular way?
Well, I was dealing with this subject matter for many years prior to actually making of it a book in the wake of my work here at the Jerusalem Post. So the subject matter wasn't alien to me. What's more, that I also studied it in a more systematic way at several universities. I should also stress that I grew up with this subject matter at home because my father, may rest in peace, spent many years working on behalf of the Jewish people in many distant corners of the world, where he helped set up Jewish educational systems, from Iran and India to Turkey and North America, in fact.
Wow. So he really experienced this firsthand, this sense of Jewish people being dispersed throughout the globe, in a sense.
Absolutely.
Looking for roots or looking for a sense of home. At one point, you call Jews history's ultimate nomads. Jewish communities have for centuries been prone to appear, disappear, and reappear almost anywhere, arguably belonging simultaneously everywhere and nowhere. That's a fascinating concept, but probably a really difficult one, I think, especially for most Americans to understand, that idea of a people being nowhere and everywhere. Explain a little further what you mean by that.
That's very true what you say about the contrast between this experience and the American experience, because on the one hand, the American experience actually does resemble this in the sense that almost every American is himself and herself the consequence of someone's immigration sometime in a previous generation. However, the American experience of immigration is usually linked with also an experience of a transformed nationality. If one was originally an Italian and then relocated to America, one simply became an American. The Jewish nation, throughout the millennia in which it was living in dispersal, managed to relocate physically while not shedding its spiritual heritage. That is what made its experience so unique. At the same time, the very existence of such a nation in such a geographically disjointed way made it not only distinctive, but also a matter of curiosity. And we know already of ancient scholars that were baffled by this phenomenon, some positively, others negatively. And we know that also already in biblical times, there was a man in Persia who used the Jews' dispersal in his times, that is a good 2,500 years ago, and more than that, in order to try and argue with the Persian emperor that the Jews should be exterminated. That was Haman from the Book of Esther. So this state of dispersal is almost as old as the Jewish people itself and has always been a subject of great curiosity.
You say at one point, the Jewish nation indeed is, and apparently has been practically since its inception, so geographically stretched and culturally fluid that its dispersion set it apart from other nations even more so than its distinctive laws, rules, tradition, languages, and dress. That's probably also an important thing for us as Americans to think about. That I mean, I was just in New York City yesterday, and so here I am, a Midwestern Lutheran, by the way, and the moment I would pass on the street someone of the Jewish faith, and I would Jews dressed in traditional garb and so on, and I might think to myself, boy, that is so distinctive. And of course, that is not the ultimate distinctiveness of someone of the Jewish faith, but rather this other thing which is hidden to the naked eye, but which is so much a part of who the Jewish people are and how they view themselves in the world.
That's very true. And one should also stress that the American chapter in the dispersal of the Jews is itself unique because of America's own distinctions. America and its impressively successful exercise in cultural pluralism are unprecedented in history, and until today, in my view, constitute all that is unique and happy about the American experiment. This has not been the Jewish experience in America has not at all been the Jewish experience in previous lands where the Jews ended up in large numbers. Usually in such countries, they were set apart actively through all kinds of decrees that set them apart in terms of dress, in terms of housing. They would be quartered in special neighborhoods, often fenced around. This is what came to be known as the ghetto. There were special laws restricting their access to business, and that is part of how they ended up being set apart. And beyond that strictly legal restriction, there were also philosophical theories attached to them by various schools who sought to discriminate the Jews, beginning, of course, with the Catholic Church back in the Middle Ages, that made a whole ideology of presenting the Jews as inferior and trying to instill this thinking in the masses' minds.
Mm. At one point, you try to explain this to us, and it is difficult maybe for us to understand if we ourselves are not part of this tradition. You say that the Jews' very ability to survive rootlessly made Gentiles embrace the wandering Jew stereotype, and that stereotype is at least part of what's at the root of some of this mistreatment of the Jews. Tell us, first of all, a little more about this stereotype and the way that it has been played out in various countries, the way in which various traditions have looked askance at the Jewish people because of this wandering Jew image.
There was, first of all, the image was so pervasive that many Jews also adopted it. For instance, there was a big scholar in 17th century Amsterdam. His name was Manasseh ben Israel. who later played an important role in reopening Britain or England to Jewish settlement. But in any event, that man was a major publisher in his time. He had his own printing press in Amsterdam. And his personal stamp was an image of a wandering Jew. And so, in other words, that was a very famous stereotype. But beyond the stereotype, there really was a medieval Catholic thinking that thought that the Jew should be compelled to never have a piece of land under his feet to call his own, and that should in turn be a testimony to God's punishment for the Jewish nation's ostensible rejection of God's gospel. Of course, a kind of thinking that today most Christians, including the Vatican itself, emphatically reject. But back then in the Middle Ages, this kind of thinking really was attached to the Jews. So the Jews were not only perceived as nomads, but were also made to become such, even if they weren't such. And so they were repeatedly in Europe expelled from one town to another and could never be completely confident that a place where they were, sometimes for many generations, would be still their place of residence several years afterwards.
So we have to think about the term nomad as, I suppose, a kind of peasant in terms of status. And if one views the Jews as nothing more than peasants, wandering peasants, then that is why in the minds then of those with this belief,
That it was an image of someone who is always prone to be physically transient, someone who could be seen in a certain locality today and tomorrow in another and the following day in yet another, sometimes, or in most cases, because somebody drove him out of his previous location. That was the image of the wandering Jew, and there was also a reality beyond it, behind it, because the Jews really were, under those circumstances, incessantly establishing new communities and new lands and going always beyond the horizon.
And
some of this, however, was not only a matter of persecution, but also a matter of entrepreneurship. Many Jewish merchants were the kinds that had this urge to conquer and go beyond the horizon and lead merchandise to the most distant locations. And this is how Jews, for instance, were among the first people to settle in the New World and start trading between the Old and the New World.
I suppose they saw the world in a different way because they were constantly wandering within it. And maybe because of that, saw some of these possibilities for commerce that might not be so immediately apparent to someone more rooted to a given spot.
That is true, and they were in that regard pioneers of globalization, which today is often a very legitimate and almost universally accepted value. But back in those days, 3, 4, and even 5 centuries ago, was novel. I should stress that in this regard, it was an urge that was shared by many in Christian Europe, but was rejected at the time by the Muslim world, where their leaders were not eager to nurture the desire to conquer new lands and go especially to conquer the high seas. And when, for instance, the Ottoman Sultan at a certain point was given a proposal to dig a canal where ultimately the Suez Canal would be, and his advisors told him, if you do that, you'll have comfortable naval access to India and China, he said, my world is here, referring to the Middle East. And at the same time, Christian explorers were circumnavigating the globe already, ultimately making the Western Hemisphere almost completely Christian, and Jews were also joining the Christians in those navigations. The Muslims were not, and they therefore were condemned to remaining within the areas where they had traditionally been, while Jews and Christians continued to, so to speak, conquer the globe.
Towards this point of the stereotype of the wandering Jew, I want you to talk for a moment about one way in which that played out much closer to our own day. You talk at one point about the terrible regime of Joseph Stalin in the Soviet Union and how Soviet propaganda against the Jews was crafted in such a way to characterize Jews as rootless cosmopolitans. That's such an interesting way to put it. And of course, that behind that language, ultimately, of course, was a what grew to be an outright hatred, and of course, a terrible delivery of evil hatred against the Jews in the Soviet Union. But talk for a moment about that perception of Jews as rootless cosmopolitans. How would that be such a frightening prospect for ordinary Soviet citizens, for instance?
That was that code language to which he resorted was meant to tap into an existing anti-Semitic impulse that existed among especially uneducated people in those parts of the world at that time. And it was deployed much the way in the Middle Ages the Catholic Church used to do that to its own flock, and the way fascist regimes did that in interwar Europe, and the way today some Arab regimes still do that vis-a-vis Israel. These are images that create an imaginary octopus or monstrosity, so some kind of a creature who's got arms everywhere and works in coordination and ostensibly is out to conquer the world and contaminate wells and do God knows what else.
Mm.
It worked well with the illiterate masses, of whom there was no shortage, especially at a time when the regime had many things to hide from the people, particularly its own manifest failure to deliver prosperity. And a good way to divert the masses' attention from the government's failure is to blame the Jews. If even through code language like this, rootless cosmopolitanist image that you cite.
Hmm. Well, and it's interesting because when one uses the term cosmopolitan, I mean, it entirely depends on the context in terms of whether or not you're using that as a point of praise for someone, or if you are actually criticizing someone. And of course, this was carefully aimed at a citizenry who would look at the idea of one being cosmopolitan. That would be a source of, that would of threat. Of I suppose the implication is that it would be someone cunning and worldly, not simple wanderers, but somehow worldly wanderers who could really impact your life negatively in all kinds of different ways.
Absolutely, I think anyone for whom. Cosmopolitanism is a negative value, is someone who actually fears freedom. And this is exactly what the Soviet Union was about. It not only prevented people from enjoying freedom, it feared freedom. This is why it forbade, for instance, its many subjects to travel freely wherever they felt like traveling. You needed a passport in that empire even to travel within its borders, let alone in order to leave those borders. And someone who has such a perception of freedom and such a perception of the outer world, of course, genuinely perceives cosmopolitanism as a negative value. I think in today's world we see that those who appreciate cosmopolitanism and any aspect of pluralism are the ones who also ultimately win the day and fare better and give their offspring better opportunities for a future. And I think much of this is also at play in what we are increasingly calling the clash of civilizations between today's Western world and the parts of the world who have a problem with all the progress that the Western world has come to epitomize.
Hmm. Let's circle back for a moment to the point you made earlier about America being a very exceptional chapter in this history of the Jewish diaspora. In fact, I think you head up that chapter, America, a diaspora unlike all others. And I believe the essential point of its uniqueness is that these Jewish emigrants were assimilated into American society, and I think maybe you even say at one point, treated nearly as equals almost from the beginning in a way that was not typically the case in other places. Am I characterizing that correctly?
Absolutely, yes.
And I guess you're saying that there was something about this new land of America, something about the way it was created and why it was created, that made this relationship with the Jews possible.
That's very true, and I think, therefore, that the jury is still out in terms of the future of American Jewry. Many people are saying today, and they're right statistically, that American Jewry is shrinking, and who knows what its future will be, and if its rate of shrinkage continues at its current pace, then it may disappear within a century or two. And I say that I have no idea where all these demographic trends are headed, although Jewish history is also repeatedly surprised people in these regards. But setting that aside, I say that America has been markedly different from any other Jewish diaspora experience because the Jews were part of its very establishment. They were not welcomed into an already fully built America. They participated in building it, not only physically but also mentally. When the Constitutional Congress assembled in Philadelphia, there was, within walking distance of their assembly, a functioning synagogue. Jews fought with the Patriots and helped finance the war for America's independence. And therefore, the American situation is entirely different from any other diaspora situation. I think that American Jewry is not only legitimate, but it's also flourishing in a spiritual way that few people appreciate, especially here in Israel, where people have this understandable sense of preponderance, feeling that this is the place where Jewish history is being reinvented. I say about that America is very different from the rest of the places where Jews set up communities in history, and the jury is still out concerning American Jewry's future.
One point you say about the Jews is that the way that they worship was very much affected by being spread across such vastness in the globe. Could you explain a little further about the way in which that worship life has been affected by this experience of the diaspora?
Sure. There were many traditions that were passed orally over the centuries, and only at very relatively advanced stages came to be written down. The most famous of these is a legal codex called Shulchan Aruch. It was written in the Galilee, that's the northern part of the land of Israel, in the 16th century. And only later arrived in Europe, and with many local exegesis. And both, compilation indicates that between the Jewish communities of the Muslim world and the Jewish communities of the Christian world over the centuries, and in a natural way, various differences of practice have emerged. They're not that major. They are in the senses of how, for instance, various prayers are said, the exact wording of this or that sentence can vary. Certain small details within how the Sabbath is observed can be different. But the point is that local traditions always emerged because when communities lived in a secluded way in far-out places for centuries, obviously they developed some traditions that were unique to themselves. These discrepancies have only come in recent years, particularly after the Holocaust and with so many Jewish diasporas ending up in Israel. You could see that there is a rapid tendency towards a re-unifying of Jewish traditions, and there is in Israel an emerging new Israeli way of practicing the Jewish faith. Obviously, I'm talking right now within Orthodoxy. As for the non-Orthodox denominations that prevail in America, in Israel, for now, their following remains limited.
the book again, a magnificent one called The Diaspora and the Lost Tribes of Israel, published by Hugh Lauter Levin Associates, and its author, Ematz Asael. Ematz Asael. I thoroughly enjoyed reading this book. I learned so much, and I appreciate the chance to speak with you about this book on The Morning Show. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And in this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we are returning to The Morning Show archives for a conversation that I first recorded back in 2008 with a woman by the name of Dana Rosenthal, a producer for Israeli television and Israeli radio, and an instructor at Hebrew University, and the author of a really interesting book called The Israelis, Ordinary People in an Extraordinary Land. In this book, Dana Rosenthal examined Israel not so much as a nation-state and not so much from a political point of view, but really examining the lives of the people who live in Israel and their day-to-day experience and the tensions which they experience and the issues which they confront on a very, very regular basis. The book was published by Free Press. Right off the bat, in the book's introduction, you quote a friend of yours from CNN saying, our viewers are confused. We have footage of Jews who look like Arabs, Arabs who look like Jews, black Jews, bearded 16th century Jews, and sexy girls in tight jeans. Who are these people anyway? That is the question. And in a sense, your book seeks to be at least part of the answer.
Right. That's what I found is that even though, as you said, Greg, Israel gets the lion's share of the world's headlines, it seems almost every day Israel is in the news, the misconceptions about Israel are immense. Most people don't realize how tiny it is. They think it's slightly smaller than China. Israel's smaller than New Jersey, and the population of Israel, 6.7 million people, is only slightly larger than the city of Baghdad. And I found that most people don't even realize that one out of five Israeli citizens are Muslim. In fact, the most common name for an Israeli boy right now is Mohammed. We've got Christian Arabs who happen to be the most educated and the most affluent of all Israeli citizens. As I meet journalists this week, my book just came out, I've been writing down some of the questions I've been asked, and I can't believe them.
It's interesting. You give us symbolically a number of different images which tell us how diverse the nation of Israel is. One of my favorite moments is when you list just different kinds of headgear which various Israelis wear through the course of their daily lives, depending on whether they have a particular station in life or a part of the army or whatever. But just that in and of itself, in a nutshell, gives us a better sense of how diverse this population actually is.
Right. Actually, I'm one of the lucky authors, and very few authors like their book covers, but my book cover actually does reflect the book. And on it, I have an Ethiopian woman who has her afro partially covered, and I've got a female soldier with her headgear, she's an officer, and by the way, Israel is the only military that drafts women, Jewish women, into the army. And we've got a surfer on the cover and a disco babe who's, people don't realize, that not all the discos in Israel explode, and actually the nightlife in places like Tel Aviv make New York look pretty tame.
You do mention the fact that this book is primarily about Israeli citizens. We don't know quite so much about, for instance, others who live within the boundaries of Israel or in the region, but we certainly get a sense, and the epilogue of the book explores some of this too, of that situation and that turbulence, which you liken to an estranged family forced to live separately together in the same house because no one will move. What a beautiful way to summarize a really troublesome situation.
Right. You know, what I decided to do is to be in the book, and I have Israelis telling their own stories, so you have to be an Israeli citizen, and the book's over 400 pages, so I had plenty of Israelis to talk about. And I wanted people to hear the diversity of voices, because when you watch television, for example, TV reporters tend to get people that speak English, because Americans don't like to read subtitles or hear people with an accent. So you get a really skewed view of who Israelis are. I have only three Americans, American-born Israelis in my book out of hundreds of people, because there are very few Americans or English speakers, native English speakers living in Israel. And, of course, the Palestinians are a very important component to the region. I think the diversity among Palestinians is fascinating, and I certainly would be eager to read a book, have someone write this book, because there's a huge untold story there about the difference between someone living in Ramallah, who's a Christian, and someone living in Hebron, who's a fundamentalist Muslim. That's not in my book, for the large part. I have Israeli citizens telling their own stories.
And you made a point of this book being about ordinary citizens versus politicians and other elected officials. This is a book about ordinary people caught up in, of course, rather extraordinary circumstances.
Right. What I decided to do is to be in the book. Not only did you have to be a citizen, but you're not allowed to be famous or a politician. We tend to hear the same rhetoric all the time from politicians, which doesn't really teach us much. And 2,000 years ago, Plato once said, politicians are not born, they're excreted. So I kept that motto in mind when I wrote the book. I went into boardrooms and bedrooms and brothels and basketball courts and playgrounds to have Israelis telling their own stories. When I went into high-tech companies, I talked to a lot of the engineers and scientists, but also the Tunisian-born woman who serves the food in the cafeteria. I went into an exclusive health spa, but I interviewed the Ukrainian immigrant who washes the floors. What I found is that a lot of, there's really an other Israel. Half of the Jews in Israel are not, as they are mostly in America, Ashkenazi or European origin Jews. Approximately half the Jewish citizens of Israel are Jews whose families left or fled Islamic countries in the Middle East or North Africa. So a Woody Allen movie is completely foreign to them. They've never heard a word of Yiddish, and gefilte fish is some bizarre food that is tasteless. These are Jews who have very, very different cultures, and you feel that an Iraqi Jew or a Moroccan Jew has as much diversity as between an American and a Greek. People don't even realize that a quarter of Baghdad was a Jewish city. So I have these types of Jews tell their stories. And again, there's enormous diversity among Israeli Christian Arabs. And I go into their communities. I spend a lot of time in Nazareth, Jesus' boyhood town. And we meet an editor of an Arabic language Cosmo-type magazine who puts out a magazine that would get her killed in most Arab countries, where she talks about hymenectomies, where women have their hymens put back in because, God forbid, they're not a virgin if they're getting married. And we have an Arab Christian who runs a meditech company in Bethlehem, and his employees are Jews and Muslims and Christians who'd have two different Christmases, December 25th and January 7th, and they vote for 30 different political parties right in Nazareth. And they save lives around the world, his medical devices. So I don't think people realize that it's a country where buses don't explode every day and that people continue to have sex and go to discos and surf on the beach.
We're talking with Donna Rosenthal. The book we're talking about is The Israelis, Ordinary People in an Extraordinary Land. One of the things I want to explore is something about that title, because in a sense, we are, of course, talking about ordinary people, the unfamous. And yet one wonders, how possible is it to be an ordinary person when one lives in an extraordinary land and in extraordinary times and caught up in extraordinarily challenging circumstances? Is it possible for ordinary people to remain truly ordinary, or to some extent at least, do they become transformed by the extraordinary that is in their lives?
That's a very good question. And as one psychologist explained to me, is the routinization of terror. I go into a mall in Jerusalem and I show what's going on. People are watching a split television screen in the mall. On one side, you've got bodies from an exploded bus and body parts and people crying. And on the other side of the TV screen, you have a soccer game going on, because it's a frequency that now people can't even bear to watch TV sometimes. You have people take buses all the time. You have to, but it's you just, part of taking a bus is kind of noticing who the other passengers are and what languages they're speaking, and where you should sit on the bus is a big decision. Should you sit in the front where it doesn't tend to explode as often or as many deaths? Kids are used to going to school where you have armed guards in front of every school in Israel, whether it's a Christian or Muslim child. And people are used to now, the last 3 years since the Intifada, when you go to a restaurant, you choose it more often, not by the quality of the food, whether it's Italian food or Thai food, but the quality of the security guards in the front of the restaurant. But to answer your question, I had a very interesting dinner in Tel Aviv recently. My Israeli friend didn't make a reservation, and we had to get not a good seat on a beachfront restaurant, and there was samba music on the beach. People were dancing on the beach, fantastic food, girls in sexy clothes. And I said to him, this atmosphere, David, feels like we're in Rio de Janeiro. And he said, Donna, you know, I've always wanted to go to Rio, but I'm really afraid. It's so dangerous.
Wow. You have made an interesting choice in your book in that the first chapter involves the whole issue of terrorism and the shadow of terrorism under which Israelis live. And, of course, not just Israelis, but really every citizen in that region to some extent or another lives with the very real threat of terrorism somehow entering their existence. You take us specifically in your book into one of these bus bombing incidents in which a number of different people are killed, but you really manage to make that very personal by sharing with us names and stories of some who were killed in this particular incident, one of many. Tell us the decision and why you made it to lead off your book with a story about carnage and suffering.
That's a good question. You know, it was hard for me. I was walking on eggshells while I wrote the book because I wanted Israelis to tell their own stories and to be as even-handed as possible. But I thought that no matter who you are, you're all affected by what goes on. And I wanted to show this one bus in Jerusalem how it impacted lives of Muslim Israelis and Christian Israelis and Jewish Israelis. And I decided when I was, I wrote this chapter last because I wanted to get a fresh bombing. Isn't that sick to say such a thing? But I did. And I said to myself, the next bus, I wrote the book mostly on the Street of the Prophets in Jerusalem, which turned out to be ground zero in Israel. There have been so far 11 suicide bombings within approximately 3 blocks of my house. You can judge the severity of a terrorist attack, even if you're a little kid, you know, by counting the number of sirens you hear. So I said, the next bus that explodes, that's the one I'm going to profile. Unfortunately, a dear friend was on the bus, and that day a friend of mine was getting married in Jerusalem. And it turned out that one of the guests at her wedding was a cousin of the bus driver who was killed, and he rushed right after the funeral because Jews bury their dead right away. An hour later, he was dancing at her wedding. And I said, how can you be dancing at a wedding when you've just buried your cousin, the bus driver, a Kurdish Jew, by the way? And he said, this is not the first time I've done this. It was his third wedding and a funeral on the same day.
Wow. Another really telling moment in this chapter, which you have written so beautifully, by the way, is when you talk about the medics working to remove those who were injured. We should mention that there were 19 people killed. There were 74 people injured. And you say, as they were working, the medics could not tell who were Jews, who were Arabs. Medical workers make no distinction. In maternity and emergency wards, Arabs and Jews lie next to each other in morgues, too. There is a lot of food for thought in those few words right there.
Well, thank you. Yeah, in fact, one of the most endearing Israelis in my book is named Yasser, who I just spoke with. He's a pediatrician in Haifa, and he's treating Jewish and Muslim children who were wounded in this restaurant that exploded in Haifa, which was run by an Israeli Arab Christian and an Israeli Jew, or you had Jews, Muslims, and Arabs all eating together in this beautiful scene in Haifa, and then they all exploded. So you have a Muslim pediatrician named Yasser, of all names, treating his Jewish patients and having a nervous breakdown because this is a 5th terrorist attack right under his window. The links between Jews and Arabs are quite remarkable. There's new DNA evidence showing that the children of Avraham and Ibrahim have a stronger genetic link than one would expect. I discovered it myself 2 weeks ago. I have a very rare eye disease, a cornea disease called keratoconus, which I've had since 1969, and I've never met anyone in America with this disease. I was in Nazareth telling four Arab Christian journalists that I'm donating part of the proceeds of the sale of this book, The Israelis, to the Israel Organ Donor Bank, which saves the lives of Arabs and Jews and Palestinians. And they said, well, what was your disease? Because I had a cornea transplant, and I see 2020, and the book is dedicated to my donor. I told them the name of the disease, and three of the four of them had someone that they knew, or one her husband has this disease. And I said, this is statistically impossible. I mentioned this to an Israeli Jew whose parents came from Iran, and she said, oh, well, I have it in both eyes. Then I called I tracked down a doctor last week from an American who had been working at the King Fahd Khalid Eye Hospital in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and 40% of his patients have keratoconus. It turns out it's highly genetically common among Jews and Arabs in the Middle East. And another example, a very strange discovery, that we are genetically linked.
Wow. You mentioned at one point, in a country with one Muslim Montague for every four Jewish Capulets, of course, drawing on the image from Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, you say not many Muslim Jewish Israeli couples live together openly. But that seems to imply that there are at least a few that manage to do so, which is sort of an incredible thought in this day and age.
Yeah, nobody knows exactly how many. There was a wonderful documentary made recently by an Israeli Arab from Nazareth, interviewing mixed couples, Arab Jewish couples, in the West Bank, Gaza, and in Israel proper, who tell their own stories. It's certainly not easy. In the book, I tell the story of a Jewish Israeli nurse at a hospital who noticed a note on the windshield of her car, and had been smashed, and she called, and it was a doctor at the same hospital, and they had coffee, and he offered to pay the damages, and it developed into a romance. And he's a Muslim doctor, Muslim Israeli doctor from the Galilee, a village in the Galilee, who was a widower, and I detailed the romance they had in Jerusalem, which is in the geography of fear. There's a geography in Israel, and especially in Jerusalem, where there's one on maps, but one inside people's minds, which is a darker map. And the problems they've had since the Intifada started, being in love.
You mentioned an interesting statistic, which is that Israel is one of the world's most densely populated countries. And for that reason, it's nearly impossible to remain anonymous.
Yes.
What do you think is the most important significance in terms of how that changes a typical Israeli's life or personal life?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons Israelis love living in Israel, because everybody knows everybody and you're not alone for long. And it's also a reason that many young Israelis, the minute they finish the army, either go to Southeast Asia or India or to South America. You know, one of the beauties of it is 2 weeks ago in Jerusalem, because of this eye disease I have, my contact lenses tend to pop out. And I lost one of my lenses, popped out in the crowded part of Jerusalem. And I was crawling around on the sidewalk, and within minutes, I had about a dozen people offering me advice and crawling around on the sidewalk with me, trying to help me find it. And my cousin once said, we'll help you replace your lens, he'll get you a discount, or maybe it's stuck in your bra, we'll help you find your contact lens. And a week earlier, I had been in Paris, and the same thing happened, and I was in the Quartier Latin, the Latin Quarter at night, a very crowded area, crawling around on the sidewalk looking for my contact lens. And no one would help me. And finally, a cop came up and started screaming at me to get off the sidewalk and get going. So that's a little bit of the beauty of Israel, where you have everybody knowing somebody or knowing something and offering you advice. You can't take a taxi without the driver asking you if you're married. And if you say no, then he'll ask you why not, and do you have a boyfriend. And if you say you're married, he asks how many children. And if you don't have children, he'll ask you why and tell you about an in vitro fertilization clinic that you can go to for free. Israel has more per capita than anywhere in the world. So there's that family feeling, whether you're a Christian, Muslim, or a Jew, or you're in China, if you're one out of a million, there's 100,000 other Chinese exactly like you. In Israel, if you're one out of a million, there's six or seven Israelis just like you. So it's really hard to have privacy, and in a way that's nice. Everybody seems to be your mother or your father or your, and it's also hard to have adultery because it's very hard to keep a secret in Israel, as Bibi Netanyahu found out.
You devoted quite a significant section of the book to a topic which you group as one nation, many tribes. And in the pages of this section, we get a sense of just the breadth of the diversity of the population of Israel, which you were talking about, and especially the fact that you have people not only that have sort of grown up there within that region, but many, many people that come from other places.
Right. You're talking about the immigrants?
Yes.
Yeah, Israel is a country that... if you don't understand immigrants, it's hard to understand the country. One of the most interesting, or the two most interesting immigrant groups that I have in my book, I think, and the Israelis are the Ethiopians and the Russian speakers are those who came from the former Soviet Union, who are over 1 million since 1989, since the Soviet Union broke up. And that's the equivalent of the United States absorbing the entire population of France. So parts of Israel feel like Moscow on the Mediterranean.
It was very interesting to learn something about the Israeli army. You mentioned the fact that Israelis have always lived in a state of war or semi-war in a country that has never had permanent borders. And for that reason, the Israeli army is very central to this nation, a very high priority, and of course very much a reality for nearly all of its citizens. I did not know, for instance, that Israel is the only country in the world that drafts women. And even beyond that, service in the army is very much expected and important to the lives of most Israelis.
That's true. It's kind of a giant, not a melting pot, but a salad bowl. It's where an Ethiopian Jew might share a tent with a Druze, who it's a different religion, and a Bedouin Muslim, and they all talk about their girlfriends and soccer, and you have women who now you have F-16 pilots, a women pilot finally, and you have women officers who are 40% of the Israeli army, approximately, are female.
Well, despite all the terrorism and the presence of the army and the kind of unrest that is a part of this nation, there are also, of course, those who hope for peace and who work for peace. And you make an interesting choice in ending your book with a beautiful little image of school children presenting a play, a peace child play. Tell us about that, and tell us about the hope which you think it perhaps represents for the people of Israel.
I'm delighted to Greg. What I think in any country, to see the future, you have to see the children. And when you see children, they learn hatred and prejudice from their parents. Peace Child is a wonderful organization of Arab Christians and Muslims and Jews where children actually put on their own plays, and they meet sometimes weekly with people that they normally, children that they might not have ever met, even though they're living 5 miles away. In the last scene of the book, the Israelis, I have these children putting on this play for their parents, who are sitting, their parents and their grandparents who are sitting in the audience, some of whom never met, and the parents are, when the lights went up, the parents looked embarrassed and puzzled and proud. I think really the hope is in the children, and I think the hope is also in jobs, and I hope we see more factories going up than fences. As one man that has 5 industrial parks inside Israel that employs Arabs and Jews and has been doing this for over 30 years, you can already see the future if you go to visit these industrial parks in Israel or Intel's dining room, and where you see Arabs and Jews worrying about computer chips and not killing each other.
Donna Rosenthal, her book is The Israelis, Ordinary People in an Extraordinary Land, published by Free Press. Tomorrow on the morning show, it is the monthly visit of Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, offering his analysis of current events. Friday's morning show includes a couple of other morning show programs out of the archives, including a conversation with the author of a book called Dennis in Iowa, which takes a very discerning look at